LGIM Talks is produced by Legal & General Investment Management, providing you with the investment ideas we just can't stop talking about. This podcast assumes a certain level of knowledge of financial markets and is intended for investment professionals.
I'm Simon Chenery, head of DC Client Solutions, and I've got Colin Clark with me, who's head of Product Policy Strategy for Workplace DC Pensions. We wanted to unpick the DC code, which came out. When did it come out, Colin?
It was July 2016 was the latest version. The DC code has been around in various forms since 2013. And over the last few years, the regulator has been improving and enhancing the code. And the 2016 review was to incorporate a lot of the additional governance requirements that came in around 2015. So the need for charges to be capped in auto-enrolment schemes and the formal obligation on trustees to assess value for money.
Right, because I remember that when we looked at it, what we were trying to do is sort of, as I say, unpick it for really, I suppose, to help trustees in their pursuit of better. What does better look like? And in fact, we even wrote in the short paper that we published in April this year, really a kind of, well, we started with an MOT, didn't we? The idea of how can we be helpful and go through the kind of key messages of the DC code. But I guess really what we were looking at was things like better governance, better member outcomes, better risk management. But I think quite quickly we thought, well, what does all that actually practically mean? And so we drafted this short paper, highly recommended, easy to read. And it's really, it's more than a checklist. But I think what we're trying to do is pithily summarize this code and offer some useful guidance. So with that in mind, Colin, maybe you can just summarize what the key messages were.
Of course. I mean, the code itself is quite a long read. It's a very long document. And I think our biggest challenge when we came up with the paper was trying to summarise all of that information, all of that really good information that trustees should familiarise themselves into something that's short and succinct and really gets the key messages home and picks out the most valuable things that trustees need to think about when reviewing their governance. Yeah. I mean, the first thing that we would suggest trustees do primarily is to read the DC code.
That always helps,
yeah. And be familiar with exactly what the regulator expects. There's various themes within the code, such as looking at investment strategies, making sure that they're appropriate for the membership, making sure that they deliver value for money, and a very clear message around challenging advisors and service providers, carrying out due diligence, periodical reviews, making sure you're getting the right management information from those service providers to show you as trustees when something's not going quite right. So what are the trigger points? What are the alerts to tell you that things aren't quite right and make sure that you challenge them and you engage with them to do a better job? Mm. But with all of this comes a challenge around resources. So as a trustee board, have you actually got the right resources to be able to meet those requirements? Not so much number of people, but have you got the right expertise on your board? Have you got the right skills? And do you have collectively enough expertise to be able to make sure that you're running your scheme as best as you can to deliver the best outcomes for your members?
Mm. I mean, I'll pick up the investment strategy in a moment, but just I know this has been done to death, but the focus on value for money, it might be worth you just highlighting this, because it isn't just about low cost, is it?
That's right, Simon. Value for money means different things to different people. It's not all about low cost, although that is a factor. It's around making sure that your members are getting the most value they should be getting from the services that you've arranged for them. Price is one thing to measure, but also the quality of communications. Do you deliver communications through multiple channels? Can customers engage digitally? Is it just an expensive paper-based process? Servicing performance as well. Yep. members might view the speed of responses to inquiries better than they might do some other aspects of it. So I think the key message around value for money is that it's important to understand the aspects of service and the scheme design that your members place the most value on. Because it's all very well as a trustee board sort of meeting a few times a year and then having the discussion amongst yourselves about what you think good value looks like. It's equally, if not more important, that you actually try and find out what your members value. So periodically ask them, carry out surveys. If you're a scheme that has member-nominated trustees, make sure that they've got the opportunity to put their voice across at trustee board meetings. So really look to get the members' views before you start making changes for what you might perceive to be delivering good value just because of price.
Yeah, I'm nodding vigorously to all that. And I think that's a nice segue into the investment strategy because, of course, we've always talked about an appropriate default and appropriate for the majority of members, which is possible to do in accumulation when people are saving for their retirement. But I find it interesting and that emphasis on member is particularly relevant now in a post-freedom and choice world where I'm seeing, and I'm sure you'd agree, a transition from the kind of early accumulation focus towards decumulation because freedom and choice created all these choices and then what are individuals going to do? So I think the DC code does, you know, also touch on this in terms of you know, thinking about relevant pathways. And I find it really interesting that the most recent FCA, paper looking at what pathways might look like in retirement. So I'd say we were hugely ahead of the curve.
That's absolutely right. And Freedom and Choice has completely changed the landscape. Before April 2015, the choices were sort of pretty much most people would buy an annuity, they'd take their tax-free cash, very few people would go into drawdown because it wasn't traditionally seen as the right sort of thing for the mass market. So most people just took the path of least resistance, bought an annuity, took their cash. But the government completely changed the landscape and now people have got a myriad of different choices available to them. They don't have to do one single thing. They can mix and match. They can put some of their money to buy a guaranteed income. They could put some of it into a rainy day fund. They could put some of it into sort of short-term annuities, those kind of things, and traditional drawdown. So, you know, for your average member, the choice is just very, very difficult to comprehend.
It's quite
sometimes
bewildering, isn't it?
It is. That's right. Yeah.
I mean, it's interesting that talking to companies, certainly a significant number still have a glide path, a de-risking glide path down to an annuity. And yet, you know, certainly from our own evidence and what I've seen across the industry, not many people are buying annuities right now. It doesn't mean that they won't in the future, but certainly I think it's something like around 5%. Of the numbers that we've seen of people arriving at retirement looking to buy an annuity. So an awful lot are actually taking cash, and I suppose that's not surprising given that, you know, pots are relatively small. But something like 84% of our total customers taking money took cash. But, you know, I wonder if trustees are a little bit looking at the rearview mirror and not anticipating the idea that, as you say, that it's all about choice. And increasingly, it looks like drawdown is going to be where people want to settle. I think the fact that there is this huge cloud of uncertainty around retirement about choices, you know, the idea that, you know, trustees are really going to be able to or need to help members and engage, your point earlier about engaging members, finding out what they want to do, is going to be really, really top of the list.
That's right. And traditionally, the shift the focus for trustees has been very much in the accumulation phase. Investment pathways have all, you know, as Simon said, has been geared towards buying an annuity, and it's been a sort of fairly sort of easy option for trustees just to have a single default strategy that was based on that. But evidence shows that there's been a clear shift in behaviour. A significantly fewer number of people are buying annuities now than they used to. Whether we see that taking off again in the future, you know, whether this is just a blip in the road, if you like. But, you know, over the last couple of years, there was an initial dash for cash, I think is what people used to call it, sort of shortly after April 2015, where most people who were tempted by the idea of withdrawing these large sums of money cashed in all of their pots. Whether they come to regret it in a few years' time remains to be seen. But the dash for cash is probably over now, and more people are going into drawdown, which means that trustees, for those schemes that offer drawdown, are going to have people in their scheme that they need to look after for a lot longer than they would have done in the past. Quite often when people bought an annuity, the trustees would then discharge any further obligations to those members. They would buy an insurance policy, and then it would be up to the insurance company to worry about those people and make sure that the insurer's got enough money to pay out their annuities. But with drawdown, it's a completely different picture now. Those members are going to stay within the scheme. Trustees have always got to look out in the best interests of members. So now trustees need to start thinking a lot more about those ongoing relationships that they're going to have with those members that are in drawdown, and make sure that the trustee board has got the right skills to be able to look after those people, make sure that the scheme communications are fit for purpose, and that they give people the right information to help them make the right choices for them. And to make sure that the investment strategies are not just focused on one particular outcome now.
I just wanted to pick up on that point, because actually that is critical as well. Because if as you say, members are staying in plan longer, they're looking at all these options, and our evidence shows that people really don't focus on what they're going to do in retirement or make choices till quite late on. Possibly even a couple of years before they retire, then one of the things that we've written about certainly last year was around de-risking and the dangers of de-risking too early and it being more optimal to remain invested, particularly if there is this cloud of uncertainty. People don't know what they're going to do, exactly when they're going to retire. Maybe they go part-time, they work a bit longer. So, you know, this all plays back to a real responsibility and focus for trustees to actually make sure not only that there are sufficient options, but they really engage with members to, you know, to help them understand what these options are. And I just wanted to touch on one other aspect of this that came up for me, which was the DC code stressing this focus on financial sustainability of their investments.
That's right. And that's something that LGIM has been at the forefront of for quite a few years now. We do a lot of good work around sustainable investments and environmental, social and governance factors. And we're sort of very active in encouraging companies to do the right thing. Sustainability should be a key issue for trustees if it's not already, you know, because they're going to have these longer relationships with people. People are living longer and will need to make sure that their money lasts longer. And, you know, equally, the companies that the scheme invests in need to prove that they're going to be sustainable and that they're doing the right things to prolong that member engagement relationship.
And this was very much a focus of the recent DWP consultation, wasn't it? Isn't it really saying, you know, that the trustees need to consider long-term risks as well as opportunities for their members, who, after all, will be invested for many, many years into the future?
That's right, yeah. And that's a welcome step from the DWP, is to try and formalise and sort of encourage trustees to start thinking about these things in a stronger way than perhaps they might have done in the past. I've already spoken about two main versions of the DC code. There's probably going to be another version very soon once these new investment duties kick in. up until now, it's always been a case of trustees should be encouraged to look at these things and take these factors into account. But from next year, trustees are going to have to make specific references to whatever it is they're doing around ESG and sustainability factors in their statement of investment principles.
Yeah, and that's all good news as far as members are concerned, because after all, that is long-term care. So finally, maybe just we can turn and have a look at this area of advisors and service providers and what their kind of what the focus of governance is with the responsibility around governance. Perhaps you can say a few words on that.
Yeah. I mean, with all service providers, the key message should be that once you've chosen one, you know, that shouldn't be your final decision. You shouldn't rest on your laurels.
Right.
You know, you should constantly review whether they're performing how you would expect them to perform. So it's important from a relationship point of view, you know, from a very early stage when you appoint a service provider, that you set out clear expectations as to what the trustees would expect those service providers to deliver. So what service performance metrics should you put in place? What trigger points should be there to alert the trustees when things aren't up to scratch? And from an advisor's point of view, all trustees have to have advisors, but do the trustees have the knowledge to be able to challenge their advisors and not just blindly accept everything that the advisors are telling them?
Yep.
So it's absolutely essential that trustees have a very good working relationship with all of their advisors and their service providers, and don't be afraid to challenge them if they're not performing as you would expect. And ultimately, if they're really poor and they don't get their act together and sort themselves out as quickly as you would like them to, the nuclear option is to replace them with somebody else. I mean, I know that in itself creates a bit of upheaval, you know, for the scheme and the members in having to transition from one service provider to another. But if you really think that an existing provider is not delivering value for your members, then you really need to seriously think about replacing them.
Well, and it is very relevant. I mean, it's since this paper came out, and certainly this year, we've seen quite a consolidation in the provider market, and the implications for that and questions raised may well be around, you know, what are you left with, or as trustee, what is your scheme part of, and there could be legacy issues, there could be challenges around the type of platform you're on. You know, is it really future proofed? Is it able to accommodate and be flexible? Can it accommodate, you know, the requirements of the trustees?
Yeah, that's right, and scale is quite a factor. You know, if it's a small in-house operation, it could be largely manual processes. You could be using small third-party administrator firms, you know, those companies that haven't necessarily got the scale or the financial support to be able to innovate. You know, they could use old technology. So you could have a lot of those legacy issues, you know. So if replacing a service provider isn't feasible and the trustees are sort of running out of ideas of ways to get the costs down and deliver better value, then another option that should be put on the table for serious thought is whether it would be better for the members to consolidate.
Yes, and I guess what we're also seeing in the market is a lot more focus on Master Trust and, you know, the overarching issue of governance and the demands on trustees that are seemingly increasing every year. And I guess the real thrust of this paper is to say this is all about better professional, better standards for trustees. So I'm certainly aware that a number of the conversations with trustees are considering at least, what do we do with people coming up to retirement? Because if they've been in these well-governed schemes, is it appropriate to kind of then just wave them off to retail land without much guidance or any guidance, particularly if they are unadvised?
Yes, that's a very good point. And, you know, it may well be that the trustees have very good reason that they don't want to or they're not able to offer those decumulation options for their members. You know, they might not have the resources to be able to deal with those ongoing relationships. So moving them to something else where you can get equivalent, if not better, governance standards to what you have at the moment in the trust-based world is something that trustees should seriously think of. And Master Trusts are sort of becoming increasingly involved in the retirement and the decumulation space. Quite a few of the big master trusts now have a drawdown option, and some schemes will take members from other occupational schemes purely to use those options. So that's something that trustees should really think about.
So I think we'll wrap it up there. I think there's hopefully quite a lot of food for thought in that. I'll just leave you with something that we put in a little box around the DC code, four key messages for trustees, that they must act with integrity and competence, act in the interests of scheme members and beneficiaries, be financially sound and professional trustees, and lastly, have appropriate levels of knowledge. That's quite a challenge for trustees. And I think that certainly the world that we seem to be evolving into is one where there are a lot of challenges, a lot of demands from the regulator and also, you know, increasingly from the government. But ultimately, as long as we remember that this is all about the members and all about members being able to get to a good retirement, I think, you know, we hopefully have given everybody a little bit of a short, pithy guide to DC governance as it relates to the revised DC code.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, you can leave us a rating or maybe even a review if you're feeling particularly generous on the Apple Podcasts app. It really helps new listeners to find us, and we're always on the lookouts for new ways we can improve. As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in Legal & General investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of recording and do not reflect the views of Legal & General Investment Management. Legal & General Investment Management is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. And remember to share this podcast with your investment professional friends, colleagues, or even family members. And to find more great content from Legal & General Investment Management, check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website.